too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend. 'Cause I've heard it all before, and I've been down there on the floor. No one's ever gonna keep me down again. Whoa, yes.
In 1866, French artist Gustave Courbet painted a work titled The Origin of the World. It sounds even cooler in French.
L'origine du monde.
The relatively small oil painting, measuring just 18 by 22 inches and created over a period of 6 weeks, features a cropped, close-up view of the vulva, an abdomen of a naked woman, lying on a bed with her legs spread. Originally a private commission from an Ottoman diplomat who collected erotic imagery, the painting moved around to various owners and locations, eventually landing at Paris's Musée d'Orsay in 1995, where it still resides today. Artist and writer Lillianne Milgram first became obsessed with this painting when she spent 6 weeks standing at an easel in front of it, creating a copy. She explores this obsession even further in her book, L'Origine, The Secret Life of the World's Most Erotic Masterpiece. Using the storytelling tools of fiction to enhance the rich history of this painting, Milgram takes the reader beyond the facts and into the realm of the feels. From Philbrick Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential.
I guess I'd like to begin just talking about this famous painting and how you landed on focusing an entire book on this Courbet piece. When did you first become aware of this piece in your life?
I think it was really, I have to say, to be totally honest, it was a serendipitous encounter. I didn't seek it out. It kind of sought me out. That's the way I think about it in retrospect. And Courbet was never, Gustave Courbet was never really one of my most favorite painters. I knew about him as a realist, and he did, you know, pave the way for a lot of artists these days. But as far as a lot of his sort of stag paintings or nature paintings from the Jura, where he is from, you know, they don't like blow me away. But when I was in Paris on an artist residency about a decade ago, I wanted to sort of think about inspiration. I always go to museums or galleries because I'm an artist, first and foremost. And then I came across this painting, and really, it was love at first sight. It blew me away. I was just stunned by its beauty and its unapologetic presence there in the museum.
So you've had an interesting life. You were born in France. You grew up, our listeners will be able to tell you have this Australian accent, but it's also kind of this accent that feels like it's been around all over the place. And then you live in Washington, D.C. area. So you kind of have this global citizen.
I think, may I interject, because I also lived in Israel for 15 years.
So talk about an interesting mixed bag of places. You know, this piece is in the Musée d'Orsay. France is obviously known for having some of the great art museums in the world. Do you kind of feel that is your spiritual homeland and the art that's there? You know, talk about, since you've lived in so many places all over the globe, what's your connection to French culture generally now?
I'm really glad you asked that, because even though I left when I was six, you know, there's something about the place that you're born in that gets into your DNA. You really can't explain it. So when I try to talk about my connection to France, I've been back a lot of times, but I don't live there now. People go, oh, but you were a child when you left. But it's not like that. You know, that was my first language, and it was the sights and the smells and everything that sort of like went deeply inside me. So when I visit now, I just feel at home. I just feel at home there. I still speak French. I studied at university because I didn't want to, you know, let it go by. And I just feel very European, even though I've lived in so many different places. So France is very dear to my heart.
This piece was created by Courbet in 1866. Do you think that it was an intentional provocation? Was it meant to be as controversial from the start as it has ended up becoming? You know, I was talking to someone about this piece who had seen it, you know, in person and said, around the museum, people, you know, the people around them while they were looking at it, they could still feel the kind of palpable sense of nervousness that people have looking at this piece. But was that the intention from the start?
I highly doubt that, and I have very strong opinions about that. So let's put things in perspective. He painted it in 1866, and even though it's viewed by millions of people now, it was a private commission, something that a lot of people who don't know this painting, and I didn't know that fact either. So it was a private commission for a Turkish diplomat who had an erotic collection. And with Courbet, you have to think about it, a convergence of things that led to this painting. First of all, his very character. He was a rule breaker. He just wanted to do things that weren't done at the time. And he didn't like people, especially the Academy of Art, telling him what to paint or how to paint it. So having said that, he also wanted to deliver something that was never done before. And when you think about any of the nudes that you can see in any of the museums around the world, none of them are really show the female genitalia anatomically correct as the main theme, okay? This is a cropped, you know, image of just that. And he made it beautiful, absolutely beautiful. So it was the first time that it was sort of like put on a pedestal. So I think that he, for himself, was saying, what can I do that has outdone everybody else? But it was a private commission. And so it's been labeled, you know, misogynistic and pornographic all the way to feminist and everything in between. And I truly believe that it's, you know, the way you see it is in the eye of the beholder, because you can really see it in very many different ways.
So, you know, this piece he took, 6 weeks to work on. It was a very intricate process. And like you said, the backstory of the private commission, there's all kinds of stuff there. It's certainly worthy of much scholarship. It's been written about a lot. How did you kind of make the decision to make this book a work of what I guess would be kind of metafiction, as opposed mm-hmm. to going straight down the line with just a book about this piece and about him? What made you more excited about telling it in that fictional space?
Okay, I love the word metafiction. I'm going to use that.
Well, I say that because, and our listeners should know, you put yourself in this book.
Yes.
And so the idea of the Lillian that we're talking to now, there's a different version of that person that's in this book. And it kind of crosses all these interesting boundaries between real and what's fiction. And it does create this sense when you're reading it of, you know, hey, I might need to look. And I found myself Googling things many times wondering, hey, was this real or was this part of the fictional take? So very fascinating.
Yeah, I've heard that many, many times from many readers that they had to keep stopping because they kept looking things up. I think that for your listeners, one really important piece of the puzzle that we haven't sort of mentioned is the fact that I was the first copyist of this painting for 6 weeks at the Musée d'Orsay, at the Orsay Museum. Otherwise, I would not have such a strong, intimate and personal connection to this painting. So let's start there as to why and how I wrote this book. Because I did gain authorization from the museum as, like I said, the first artist. And it was an incredible experience, almost like a performance piece, which I hadn't really thought about when I first asked for permission to copy it. Because this is a painting that stops people in its tracks. So there I was for 6 weeks, every single day, painting this very intimate portrait of a woman's genitals. And I was speaking to the public all the time. So I was very, very connected, not only as an artist, but when I got back home, I just couldn't let the piece go. And I didn't know all that much about its history because when I was in Paris, I was mainly busy being the copyist. I was exhausted every night. So I read a bit about its history, but I didn't know everything about it. So when I started researching, and I do love to research, I am a history major. I just went down all these rabbit holes. I could not believe the extraordinary, I'd call it adventures or odyssey, of this painting. It really is a story of survival over a century and a half, because it was handed over secretly between all these eccentric collectors over a century and a half and across continents. And I thought, this is the most amazing story. It's got to be in a book. Now, when you think about it, I'm fortunate that I speak French, because otherwise I wouldn't have been able to get all the information I did. And most of the information about this painting is biographical or in academia, and it's mostly in French. You know, there are books that are about Courbet in English, but so I thought, no, this story has to be told. It has to be spread for the English reader, English-speaking reader. And I wanted to make the real story. I didn't have to embellish it that much. It was so exciting. But I did want to make it entertaining and enlightening at the same time. So I thought, okay, I've got to write this book. This is just asking, this story just needs to be told. And that really became an obsession for close to 10 years. And that's how long it took me to write it.
So let's set the scene. So you're at the Musée d'Orsay. You're what, sitting in front of the painting?
Standing
at an easel. And you are recreating this work while people are passing by. So it's almost this public, like you said, performance art. And people are probably doing double takes going, hey, what's happening here? What kind of questions did people have? Were they saying, you know, why would you do it? You know, because that's obviously a very, very old tradition, right? This is something that dates back centuries. Were they curious about why you were doing that and what the benefit is of doing work like that?
Yes. And in fact, like when I did ask permission to paint, to copy the painting, the head of the Bureau des Copies, the copyist department, she kind of said, you know, no one has asked to copy this painting. And she said, there's a reason, because do you realize what you're getting into? And I guess I didn't, because just like you say, people were very curious, not only about the painting, but seeing a woman there standing, you know, painting this painting, which is very revealing. And as I say in my book, because the prologue of my book is really my adventures at the museum. And what happened to me is that I began to identify more and more and more with this painting. And I became protective of it. And so when people would giggle or Twitter or things like that about it, you know, I would like engage them in conversation and speak about, you know, why they felt uncomfortable and what they felt about it. And I got all, like I said before, the entire range of responses to this painting. But also people were very cheeky, and I found it was very, a lot of men, I think, mistook me for the painting. You know, when they saw me painting this very contentious and controversial sexual painting, I think that they felt like, some of them felt that they had the right then to assume that I was also of that mindset, that they could, you know, ask me out in this sort of very crude way or whatever. A lot of women absolutely loved the painting. They really also felt what I did, that this was, you know, I am woman, I am proud of being a woman. And I do give some examples of some pretty humorous occurrences that happened when I was painting, and I'll give one about the grandmother, which is probably my favorite. It was this little French grandmother, and she was bringing her very young granddaughter to see the painting. And I thought to myself at first, well, I love that scene, you know, this grandmother explaining to the child. You wouldn't see much of that in America, I don't believe. So she was saying to her granddaughter, you know, you see, darling, my little cabbage, you know, this is where you came out from. And the little girl said, no, maman had a cesarean. And the child was only about 6 or 7. So I just love that. You know, there's this openness in Europe to this.
You know, what's interesting too is the idea of how different cultures react to this painting. Obviously, we think of this because we're so puritanical in America still in many ways. We still have very much issues with confronting the vagina, right? Like looking at it. But in France, obviously the culture is much different, and they probably think of the way we think of that painting in a very like, why is this a big deal? And And obviously sexuality and nudity generally and the female form are accepted differently in different cultures. But did you notice that the painting was reacted to differently from, you know, American audiences, British audiences, and that the French people themselves had a more open-minded sense to the
I couldn't help it. I mean, obviously people who come to a museum are, I would say, more open-minded. They come to see art. They are probably seeking culture. So even so, within that demographic, I found that the Americans were kind of shocked by it. Some were actually disgusted by it. Some were saying, you know, this doesn't belong in a museum. But I wouldn't generalize like that. On the other hand, you know, as I was painting, there would be groups, classrooms, you know, high school, middle school, led by a teacher, and they would all sit around the painting and discuss it. They started giggling a bit at the beginning, but there were some very, very sort of deep discussions about it, and it wasn't really a big deal. So there was a cultural example right in front of me almost every day about the differences in cultures. And the differences also between men and women and how they responded. You know, some men would stand there and, you know, in front of it with, you know, this really beautiful look on their face. And when I started talking to them, they would say, oh, it reminds me of my mother. Others would say, it reminds me of a past lover. I mean, there were just so many different responses. It's not your ordinary painting, let me tell you that.
Well, you mentioned, you know, that even some people were inappropriate about it, and you know, it seems like it just amplifies whatever your predisposed ideas are. So if you're a misogynistic jerk, it's just going to make you more of a misogynistic jerk, you know,
right,
like this,
right? Although I have had experiences with feminist art critic, one in particular in Seattle, and she I was talking to her, I thought maybe we could collaborate somehow. And she said, I would never do anything with this painting. I find it loathsome. And I thought, loathsome? It's such a far cry from, I see beauty in it. So to be called loathsome by another woman, not me, but the painting, it really actually shocked me. Mm. Yeah.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Really Awkward Life Drawing Classes. Sometimes you make eye contact with the model and can't seem to break it. Sometimes you actually recognize the person. Or worse, they know you and assume you signed up just to see them naked. And remember that time the model had a sneezing fit? Awkward. No one needs to experience that. Why are you even in this class, actually? You don't even remember registering for it. Wait, was this a gift? Why would someone do that to you? Grab your stuff and just go. Just go. Life drawing is not for everyone. Maybe try pottery.
When you were telling this story and trying to blur the lines between what was real and what was fact, was it hard to find the story to lay on top of it? Because, you know, when you have a novel, you have to have a narrative of some kind, right? You know, when you're telling the story of a piece, you can say, hey, here's the facts. This happened then, this happened there. But that's not going to draw you in emotionally. So right. When did the idea, if the idea began, hey, I want to tell a story using fiction about this painting, or was it one of the characters or a part of the narrative that came first that let you into that? You said, hey, that's how I can actually get into this story.
That's a great question, because it wasn't so smooth. At first, I thought, because I had been in Paris and because also Courbet himself had learned to paint by copying, because he did not want to go to the academy. He didn't want to be taught by old fogies, he called them. So I thought, oh, you know, I'm sort of following in his footsteps, because I had never done a copy before and it never interested me till I saw this painting. So I thought, okay, maybe I would start the painting almost like a one chapter about me following in his footsteps and go on like that. But then I thought, well, what happens when he passes away? The most exciting part to me was also like, what happens to the painting? Like, where does it go? And it really had some close calls there. So I thought, okay, the only really way that I wanted to write it was through the hands of the collectors. because they each had such different motivations and feelings about the painting. And I thought that was really interesting. And someone has called the book an allegory of what happened to the, you know, the perception of female nudity over a century and a half. So I went that way, and then that proved to be difficult for publishers because they always like one point of view, two at the most. And here I was with lots of points of view, but to me, the protagonist was the painting. So I never really had any doubts that this could, you know, do well. And in fact, it has done really well and won a lot of prizes, which yay for art and art history. I'm really proud of that. And also I'm talking to people about a film in development and who knows where this will lead. Mm.
Well, it's funny because I was thinking about the fact that, you know, as the painting kind of bounces around and is cared for and then sometimes not so cared for and dealt with carelessly, and it's usually at the hands of different men, you know, Yes. It is easy to see the idea of, you know, this painting is this woman and that how we valued women at that time. And the idea that you could kind of, you know, treat a person like an object, right? And that very much came through in the work. You know, you mentioned the reaction, it's been very critically acclaimed and you've gotten lots of praise and awards for that. What about readers generally, beyond just critics and stuff? Do you know, is it, what kind of response are you hearing from the actual just, hey, I read the book and liked it? Because obviously I was wondering if you had no idea what this painting was, the book still needs to work, right?
Yeah.
Right. Like if you don't know who Courbet is and you have no idea what this painting is, and it's not as if the painting is like right there on the cover, you know.
I couldn't have it on the cover. Yeah.
You know, so you have to kind of do a little bit of legwork. Did you think about the idea that it has to kind of stand alone aside from the work itself? It needs to be just a book.
Another great question, Jeff. Thanks. Because the reason that I put the prologue in about my own experience with this painting is precisely that, to connect with the contemporary reader. Because like you say, a 19th century painting, like who's going to care? Or, you know, okay, so it's got this kind of like iconic, very controversial subject. But how are you going to get the reader involved and invested in the painting enough to want to know what's going on in its life? So I wrote, because when I told people what I was doing in front, everyone was just like, oh my God, you're so brave, or what happened? I don't know much about copying. How was it in Paris at the time? What did people say? So I realized very quickly that people were also interested in my story. And so I started off, and from the very first paragraph, and I know you've read the book, from the very first paragraph, I described my description of the painting and my reaction to it. So, you know, you dive right in. There it is. There's my reaction to it. And I go on to tell about my 6-week journey in Paris. And that has been the trick to invest people. They want to know more about the painting because I make it so exciting. And it was exciting. And I also showed them at the very last part of my prologue how other artists, so many artists internationally, have been, you know, inspired by this painting, have riffed on this painting in their own way. And I finished the prologue part, my part, about a real incident that somebody took me to a billboard that had this very same painting on it just on the last day I was painting it, but it was made out of bread, cheese, and chocolate. And, you know, there it was, this huge billboard of this, you know, woman's genitalia made out of bread, cheese, and chocolate. So the chocolate obviously was the pubic bush. And it was just like, you know, this painting just had...
That's a whole other podcast, phenomenal. I think, on that one. Yeah. I'm, you know, just to kind of, as we're winding down on time here, I'm curious. One, do you still have this copy that you did?
Yeah, everyone wants to know where the copy is. And sure, I have it at home. It has not been exhibited except for one time in New York, in which it was part of an installation. However, when I've mentioned that I feel very protective about this painting, and you can tell that in my book too, I think. And I decided that I did not want to have it on the wall at home so that when people came in, I would have to explain it all over again and they'd be shocked or horrified, or I didn't know what to expect. I didn't want that painting, even my copy, to go through that all over again. It's got enough of that at the museum.
Yeah, I was thinking about the fact that, you know, obviously it's been different because of the pandemic. You haven't been able to go out and do tons of in-person events, but the idea that if you were able to go do talks, would you have the painting, your copy, next to you on an easel while you did a reading and things like that?
I have done one virtual reading for a French bookshop, and it was behind me, and I sort of like moved my head, and there it was.
It could be a little distracting too. That's another thing. You know, it seems like this book, in some ways, has, to me at least, created something of a template. And I was wondering if you've thought about applying this method to other paintings and kind of telling stories around other works of art, and using them as the jumping off point, because you've had such success with this one. Are there other things that could be done in this way, or are you kind of moving on? I'm done with the book about paintings.
I am writing a second novel, but it's not about a work of art, but it is historical fiction. However, I am a freelance journalist for the arts. And so I write for quite a lot of publications for the arts. And I love to do that because my blog, because I like to explain art to the layperson, or I like to open their eyes, or I like to make them think about a work of art. So, but I don't think I will ever find another painting that has spoken to me in this way and that I have spent 10 years of my life with. So I doubt very much I'll be doing the same thing again.
Ladies, 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 ladies. Ladies, 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 ladies. Ladies, 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 ladies. Ladies, 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 ladies.
Paris, May 29th, 2014. A gallery in the Musée d'Orsay. A performance artist from Luxembourg sits on the floor in front of Courbet's The Origin of the World, spreads her legs, exposes herself, and creates a real-life version, kind of a 3D experience. The artist was Deborah de Robertis. The performance was called Mirror of Origin. She was quickly thwarted and eventually arrested. The museum and two security guards later pressed charges. The performance artist rejected claims that it was a mere act of exhibitionism. The museum responded, "No request for authorization was filed with us, and even if it had been, it's not certain we would have accepted it, as that may have upset our visitors."
Ladies, 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 take it easy. Wendy leaves me, please be my guest. Do whatever I might have left in his kitchen.
Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Additional production assistance from Jack Dean. Theme music by Broncho. For more on the museum and the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.